It is great to have the opportunity to be here this morning and to even to witness the power of those first couple of introductory items, the video, particularly Carla. Thank you, Carla and Alan. I actually feel a bit inadequate trying to follow a heartfelt and effective presentation such as the one that Alan has just given. But I am grateful to the consortium for inviting me. And I would like to wholly endorse the human focus that this conference is taking. Understanding that when we're talking about human rights, we're talking about real people, just like Alan, just like Carla, and no doubt many other stories and journeys that could be articulated in this room. It's fundamental that we have that human focus if the implementation of human rights is to be successful. This conference provides a timely and important opportunity for all of us to challenge ourselves about how we can work together to better achieve a safe, confident and peaceful society that's built on dignity and the rights of every human being in all of our communities, just as Alan has been articulating. I believe that policing means protecting human rights, and human rights are an enabler. They're critical to effective, good policing. As police officers, we're charged with the protection of the public. To accomplish this duty, police officers are given powers to stop, to search, to arrest fellow human beings. So human rights provides a practical framework through which we can use these powers with the consent and confidence of our community. Human rights were built into the foundations of the Police Service of Northern Ireland by the Patton Report, which astutely observed that upholding human rights and upholding the law should be one in the same thing. The principles and the 175 recommendations of the Patton Report were consistent with what any modern policing service is striving for. Human rights guide the decisions that we make, the operational activity that we undertake, whether that's considering the use of force or when deliberating over budget cuts, which seems to occupy just about all of my time at the moment. So our organisation will always first look to our obligation to keep people safe and our commitment to uphold the fundamental human rights of the individuals and indeed the wider communities that we're charged with serving. Every PSNI officer makes a commitment to human rights when they take their oath of office. Protecting human dignity and upholding the human rights and the fundamental freedoms of people are also woven into the PSNI Code of Ethics. The code sets out standards and behaviours expected from your police officers and provides guidance on how they should conduct themselves in this, what I believe to be, an honourable profession that I'm very proud to lead in this jurisdiction. I firmly believe that as police officers and as human beings, it's not just what we do that's important, but how we do it. So for the Police Service of Northern Ireland, keeping people safe is what we do. Policing with the community is how we do it. Policing with the community is about understanding the human impact of policing, and that needs to be underpinned by human rights principles. A clear example is the critical importance of accountability in policing. The mechanisms provided by the Northern Ireland Policing Board and the Office of the Police Ombudsman for Northern Ireland are essential to building trust and confidence in policing. When I leave here this morning, and I'll not be running away from questions if I have to shoot early, but when I leave here this morning, I'll be on my way to the monthly public meeting of the Policing Board. In my view, these meetings are very important. The debates are always challenging. Sometimes they're uncomfortable for me as Chief Constable. But the ability to have such debates in an open and transparent arena can only be beneficial to policing. A commitment to openness and transparency is also important. Although less procedural elements of accountability, it is still critical. This is not just about the publication of policies and procedures, important though that is. It's about us telling our story. As police officers and police staff, we need to be ready to engage and work with our partners in the public, private and voluntary sector, and we need to embrace opportunities to communicate with the public through traditional and new media. As Chief Constable, my desire is to have a policy of complete transparency about police work, except when there are very real reasons to prevent that. And there are some in a very small number of cases. While there is much good practice in this area, there is always more that we can do. And this is a priority for me to continue to challenge myself and my own organisation. Accountability involves creating real participation between the police and the community. A partnership in which policing reflects and responds to community needs. In my experience, decisions that are made in partnership last longer. They're better decisions. They produce greater results, thereby improving public confidence in policing. This type of collaborative decision-making is important at every level of the organisation, whether it's between me as Chief Constable and the Northern Ireland Policing Board, between a local commander working with their local community and planning a safe parade and or protest, as often happens, or even a neighbourhood policing team working with a group of local schools on a drugs education programme for young people. Last week, the Police Service of Northern Ireland had over 11,000 calls for assistance from the public, and that was not an exceptional week. This is from answering the telephone to police attendance and follow-up investigations. We touch on human lives 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Police officers will often meet fellow human beings in a crisis, at the lowest point in their lives, in their hour of need. I want my officers to respond in a way that is professional, but also in a way that is human. Victim, witness, and offender should remember the person that they've engaged with, not just the uniform. The person who helped, who cared, who treated them with courtesy, with respect, with fairness. Every day, my officers are looking after the most vulnerable in society in a way that is little understood and little appreciated. While police officers will always help when we can, we're not always what the most vulnerable person needs. As things are at present, different public services and agencies are dealing with the same vulnerable individuals, families, and even neighbourhoods, and we go back to them time and time and time again. The one common thread in all that we do is the human impact. If we lose sight of the human impact in service delivery, we are not doing our jobs in the way that we should. Simple as that. One of the outcomes that you're seeking from this conference is to enable a partnership approach based on how we take human rights forward as a society. It seems to me that making progress on a better partnership approach is an opportunity that we cannot afford to miss. We need to think more radically about how we respond to the needs of the most vulnerable in our society. By working better in partnership across the various sectors, public, private, and the voluntary sectors, we can improve the support that we provide to the most vulnerable in our communities. And we can also save money, actually, by reducing demand across public services. Achieving this requires more joined-up working, substantially improving information sharing among agencies, and encouraging teams of professionals from different backgrounds to work together to solve problems rather than simply react to the mess. Northern Ireland presents a complex and challenging policing environment, and I want to touch upon upholding and balancing human rights while policing the threat that continues in this jurisdiction. My officers and staff are continuing to deliver a policing service while a small but dangerous number of violent dissident Republicans are actively planning attacks on the police and indeed the wider community. While the police and security services and so on remain their target, their actions have shown total disregard for the lives of our citizens, of our communities. Police response to policing this threat is based on a measured, focused human rights approach. It applies to both our overt and covert policing. For example, in policing an intelligence-led operation, our objectives are the protection of the community and putting criminals before the court. But in planning how we achieve our objectives, we consider the human rights implications for all affected by the operation. This includes members of the community going about their day-to-day business. It includes the suspected criminals targeted by the operation, but it also includes the police officers involved in implementing that operation. The often untold story of the professionalism and the bravery displayed by my officers in the most challenging and dangerous of circumstances is something that I, as Chief Constable, am incredibly proud of. They display a dignity and a respect for human life that is entirely absent in the actions and thinking of those who are trying to take life. These people who advocate the use of violence look for perceived failures in policing in order to garner community support for their violent intent. Our policing history has taught us a lot. Whilst we're seeking to protect life, we understand that police actions, and indeed police inaction, can have a negative impact on community trust and confidence in policing. Real or perceived, the inappropriate or blunt use of police powers, such as stop and search, vehicle checkpoints, house searches, and so on, can cause unease, anger, and distrust in the community. Human rights, therefore, are all the more important to be at the centre of our thinking in such challenging circumstances. Extensive accountability mechanisms also provide community reassurance that we will be held to account for this incredibly difficult area of policing. No such accountability exists for those who choose to use violence. I would therefore appeal to those of you who are in this conference today to ensure that the public discourse on human rights robustly challenges those who still want to use violence. Civic society has a powerful voice, and we have just heard some of it this morning, that can and must be heard in rejecting the use of violence against my officers and the citizens in our communities. One of the greatest challenges facing any practitioner of human rights is striking the balance between competing rights and interests in a free and democratic society. The obligation of the police service to consider the rights of everyone affected is often misunderstood or ignored. The challenge for my organisation charged with the delivery of policing in a peace-building society is that the perception of policing can very quickly become divorced from the reality at a huge cost to community confidence. As was observed in the research on the Flags protest published yesterday by Queen's University, police actions can be understood by communities in very different ways. The result of the flag dispute has been that some within the loyalist community believe that they were the subject of PSNI brutality. Conversely, some within the Republican community believe that PSNI allowed illegal loyalist protests and parades, and that issue, of course, has been the result of legal challenge. There is no doubt that the Flags protest was a challenging time for everyone in our society, and there are lessons to be learned for everyone, including policing. The reality is that community tensions continue to play out on our streets on a nightly basis. As a society, we have to challenge ourselves to find a better way for the future. Human rights should not be arbitrarily used as a tool for one individual or community to exert power or influence over another. People should not focus only on their own rights and other people's responsibilities. People must begin to consider the impact of their actions on others. As Chief Constable, I am grateful to those who have pulled this conference together to talk about building a vibrant civic space where all groups are encouraged to make their voices heard with dignity as part of a democratic discourse. As Alan has reminded us, 16 years after the Good Friday Agreement, it is clear that we have still some distance to travel. In a society where space, symbols, and history remain contested, trust in policing, which takes time and effort to win, can be quickly and easily eroded. Over the last number of years, the terms partial policing, comparative policing, differential policing have been used by both communities about the police service in equal measure. Some people talk of a dark side to the police service of Northern Ireland, while others believe that there has been a greening of the PSNI. As senior officers, we could be expected to take a wry comfort that if we are annoying both ends of the political spectrum in equal measure, then we might be getting it right. But the reality is that there is no comfort for us in the fact that community trust in policing is eroded by those perceptions. Those perceptions are held by some people that PSNI police one community differently to another. Let me be clear. Those perceptions are entirely, wholly inaccurate. My officers and I this morning may wear a dark green uniform, but the police service that I lead is neither dark nor green nor orange, for that matter. The police service that I am honoured to lead is the most accountable and scrutinised police service in these islands, if not the world. And I welcome that scrutiny and accountability. Ill-informed or erroneous commentary from those in leadership, civic and political, can fuel inaccurate perceptions that erode trust, not just in policing, but in the vision of a safe, confident and peaceful society that we are all working towards. This is not to say that policing cannot be criticised or held to account. Of course it can. Policing of itself is a human endeavour. It is carried out by human beings for the protection of human beings. As in every human endeavour, mistakes and failings are inevitable. When they occur, the only way that we will retain the public's trust if we are ready to acknowledge our shortcomings and learn the lessons. The PSNI have demonstrated our readiness and our willingness to do so through the robust accountability mechanisms of the Policing Board and the Ombudsman. Finally, I want to say something very briefly about policing the past. This conference is examining dignity and rights as a framework for the future, and that's correct that you should do that. But to talk about the future, our society also has to be ready to talk about the past. The absence of a holistic approach to dealing with our past has left a landscape of legal processes to address the pain caused by Northern Ireland's troubled history that is inadequate. The public services of today are not suitably constructed or resourced to deal adequately with the pain of our past. Delay has been a chronic feature of the current piecemeal approach to our past, and it is a failing to treat those who have suffered with the dignity that should actually be guaranteed. Unless an alternative solution is found, very regrettably, delays will increase as the impact of budget cuts continue to take their effect. Indeed, I will be discussing this very issue with the Policing Board later today. I am conscious that there is a perception among some of those who have been hurt by the past that the police service does not understand the human impact of delay in dealing with the past. This is simply not the case. I know that for many people who have suffered, the past is the present as they live every day with the pain of their loss. Delay not only increases hurt, it also erodes trust and confidence in the PSNI's ability to deal with the past and causes huge damage to public confidence in policing the present day. The reality is that reaching a solution lies well beyond the remit of policing. There is a need for a coherent approach that complies with legal obligations, but also guarantees the rights and dignity of those who have suffered. I do not underestimate the scale of this task. Agreeing a more societal approach will require brave conversations, such as those that our politicians are currently involved in across the road, as well as the conversations that you will be having here at this conference over the next 2 days. So I'm finishing now, and having taken enough of your time this morning, I will conclude by saying that if we are to retain the focus on the human being, human rights have to be more than words on a page or lofty ideals proposed in presentations such as this. Operationalizing human rights requires constant effort. It requires us to be accountable, transparent, and open to learning. In a world that is constantly changing, the implementation of human rights is a constant process. It is a job that is never truly complete, and therefore something that we cannot afford to reduce our efforts from. Conversations such as the ones that you will be having today help shape our future development in this important area. It is conversations such as this that will bring us towards the safe, confident, and peaceful society that we all desire. Thank you for your time.
George, thank you. Just a little change of plan. I know you have to be away for the policing board, which waits for no man or woman. So before I introduce our next speaker, Jim, maybe just a few questions from the floor. We have roving microphones. I'd just like to ask you, George, I mean, you talked about the need to challenge the people who pose the threat. Do you feel that the human rights industry, which we might call it, does not support the PSNI to the degree it should?
Well, I wouldn't say we're unsupported. I think the reality is that we are a public authority, and therefore the human rights principles apply to the police service and to governments in a very direct way. But I suppose at a more general level, it's almost as if there are parallel paradigms or lenses through which societies that are in a post-conflict stage view the role of the police service or the state, although I would say we're not an arm of the state, we're an arm of the citizen. But there is something about the public authority having a very clear technical accountability to be operating and balancing human rights standards. And all I'm pleading for is that civic and political leadership would also apply some of that thinking to people who have got some sort of an ideological motivation that by some perverse thinking seems to think it's okay to take another human being's life in the most extreme circumstances. And I guess I'm just trying to move the conversation towards that.
Sorry, I should have said, if you want to ask a question, please put your hand up and we'll get a microphone to you. All of these things would require half an hour on their own, George, but to the idea of the human rights being behind every aspect of a policing operation, I mean, I just had this vision of, you know, a platoon or unit going out to the riots on the 12th of July and you producing, you know, the Universal Declaration saying, just before we go out, I'll just read this over to you again. I mean, is it a matter of having that aspect of human rights so deeply embedded in the course of training officers? Because I can imagine that on the day, on the week, it's very far from most officers' minds.
Well, they may not be fully up to speed in all the latest jurisprudence coming from Europe and so on, but our officers, lesson one, day one, week one of training is on the code of ethics, which is enshrining the principles of human rights. So the lexicon, the language that we use is often around the big human rights principles of, do you have a legal basis for what you're doing? Is it necessary, even if you have the legal basis? Even if it's necessary, is this a proportionate way of doing it? Do you understand that you're going to be held to account for what you're doing? And I think when those broad principles start to become part of the vocabulary, start to become part of the norm for our planning discussions, for our response to disorder, whether that's the set piece parade and protest thing, or even a pub fight and all the rest of it, if those principles are ingrained in officers' thinking, then I
even
think
when
that's
someone's
a good
throwing
point.
A brick at you or has hit you with a brick they have thrown.
Yeah, well, human rights is not necessarily about not responding. It's about making sure that we respond in a way that has a framework of principles around it that we can stand behind and actually proudly stand behind.
Any questions from the floor for Chief Constable? Yes, please. Get a microphone to you now. Just for benefit of everyone, say which group you're representing, please.
Patrick Corrigan from Amnesty International. Just a quick question to the Chief Constable. Particularly interested in your comments towards the end on dealing with the past and the recognition that it's a much bigger issue than simply a policing approach. And I know this was a theme you addressed in your September speech, I think, to the British Irish Association. There are talks going on at the moment. There are many people, I suppose, fear that those talks will once again fail to reach a successful conclusion, as they did last year on the past, as well as other issues. Nils Muzniak, the Council of Europe Commissioner on Human Rights, when he was here in Belfast just a few weeks ago, reflected on the UK government's particular responsibilities as the responsible state party to put in place proper mechanisms to investigate the past, deliver on their human rights commitments, and if necessary, also to finance such a mechanism. Is that something you would support, given your previous comments about this needing to be an issue addressed by the government?
I'll leave it to the UK government to fulfil their own human rights responsibilities, but what I have said unequivocally and very clear about is getting a solution to dealing with the past and the legacy investigations is far bigger than a policing response. It's a societal, it's a political response. I think that the sensible thing for the politics to do is to tackle that within the human rights framework. Now, when we get to the sort of comments that you have made, I think there are valid challenges to the UK government around all of that, but I don't think it's appropriate for me as Chief Constable to enter a political space by telling the UK government or the local administration or any other government what or how to do it. What I'm saying is that policing has got a statutory responsibility currently for in continuing to deal with the past. I don't think that's an ideal solution. I think that there needs to be a change in that, and I think that the responsibility for that, what it looks like, rests with the governments. In broad brush, and I'm not talking about the detail, but the Haas proposals from this time last year, for example, feel to me and to my organisation as a sensible way forward. There'll be lots of practical implementation and legislative requirements and all of that around it, but something like that that removes us away from the police service and the police ombudsman, actually, so that we can focus on delivering a service in the here and now, whilst not disrespecting the pain and hurt that victims and families feel of the past. But I think it is a better mechanism that should be properly resourced to do that in a way that meets not just human rights obligations, but the focus of this conference around the human element and the pain and suffering that people are still experiencing in the present.
That's a long way of saying it's none of my business. yes, please. Just get a microphone front row here, please.
Thanks. Brian Gormley, CAJ. Thanks very much, Chief Constable, for that address. I have to say, as representative of a human rights organisation, I'm not sure we would have heard that speech from a leading police officer in any other jurisdiction, and thanks very much for that. However, there is an issue that I'd like to raise in terms of, again, dealing with the past. We would fully behind and fully respect your call for a comprehensive mechanism to deal with unresolved serious crimes of the past. But whatever mechanism exists, there is presumably going to be a continuing responsibility on the police service to manage intelligence-based information and disclose that to appropriate mechanisms. As you'll be very well aware, your own Deputy Chief Constable has been giving evidence on these matters to an inquest hearing over the past couple of months. And there are many worries about that process. Without going into detail about what they are. Do you have a perspective for moving that process forward and meeting some of the very real worries there are about the independence and the speed of the processes involved?
I think the PSNI and the Ombudsman, to a much lesser extent, will be the holders of information that would be relevant and necessary for any new body to have access to in order to fulfil their investigative responsibilities. I think we need clarity around the legal basis for the sharing of that information, and that is not me being obstructive. It is me actually thinking about how we deal with sometimes competing human rights. There's the need for investigations. There's also the need to protect the lives of people whose lives could be at risk if they're in private personal information went into the public domain. And I'm not sure that that wider society understands the magnitude of the material that we retain relating to the past, and combing through that time and time again on the basis of separate and not joined up queries from accountability bodies or from the coroner's court and so on is hugely time and resource intensive. It doesn't mean it's not important. It's not that we're being obstructive. We've got legal obligations to fulfil in that respect. So even for me as Chief Constable, you know, there would have been over 50 lever arch files, 3-4 inches thick, that I've personally had to read, personally, under the legislation, to allow for the release to on through the PII system, for example. That's just since becoming Chief back in June, within 4 or 5 months. So I don't want that to sound like a long list of excuses. The principle is, if we sit on the information and a new investigative authority with a statutory basis needs the information to do their job, then of course we want to cooperate with that, but nor should we underestimate the complexity and the magnitude of the task.
Thanks. We'll take one more. No, you're free to go into the lion's den. Chief Constable, thank you very much indeed.